Hi, this is Alan Chartok. I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Dr. Vincent Carcillo, President and Managing Partner of Capital District Renal Physicians. Dr. Carcillo is board certified in internal medicine and in nephrology and has been with CDRP since 2004. A graduate of the University of Scranton, he completed medical school at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. He trained in nephrology at Albert Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia. His clinical interests include transplant nephrology and hypertension. In addition to his clinical practice, Dr. Carcillo enjoys spending time with his family of five. He's a regular at the fitness center and loves to cook. He has competed in multiple triathlons, and he enjoys participating in multiple sports, including snowboarding, hockey, and racquetball. Welcome, my friend, I should add, Dr. Vincent Carcillo.
Alan, thank you so much for having me, and certainly friendship is a big part of this, and I'm so happy to be here with you.
Well, I guess what I want to accomplish today, Dr. Carcillo, is to figure out what it is about our kidneys, about renal operations, what it is that we need to know, a basic primer. So what is the kidney?
The kidney is a set of organs. We have two of them in the body, and those organs are doing a number of jobs. But the way I like to break it down in the office setting when I'm sitting one-on-one with a patient that may be facing some challenge as far as kidney function goes is a few basic tasks. One is just accounting. Kidneys are responsible for getting rid of salt and water. And so what comes in has to come out. And kidneys are helping us with that. Number two is being able to work like a filter and clean the blood of things we don't need anymore.
Like?
Those things are some things that patients who may have had kidney problems in the past would recognize, as physicians may have told them, oh, your creatinine level is high. Or something that a lot of times patients will come to me and say, what about my bun? And so there is another blood test that doctors check very, very frequently that can sometimes be elevated in patients that have kidney problems. So it comes down to waste products. Many of them are waste products from our metabolism. They're natural waste products in our blood, and the kidneys are responsible for filtering those things out, getting rid of them in the urine.
So, Vincent Carcillo, are there some things that we can help the kidney with by not ingesting so that the kidney doesn't have to do it?
There definitely are, and one of those things is just letting them do their job. And in order to do that, they need, just like any filter, they need to have a volume coming through. And so the better hydrated you are, the better able those kidneys are to flush things out of your system. Now, there are certain people who do have restrictions on the amount of fluids that they can take in. Patients that have congestive heart failure, for example, or maybe liver failure. But in many cases, in the general population, we should all try to stay well hydrated.
So we have two kidneys. And every once in a while, we'll hear that somebody's kidney has failed. And I see on your resume that you are an expert in transferring kidneys from one person to another.
Well, I don't actually do the procedure, but we do prepare so many patients in our practice who are moving in that direction, who may have chronic kidney disease that's getting worse over time. Maybe some of those patients, we can get them ready and get them to a transplant center where we can get them transplanted before they need another treatment that's called dialysis. In some instances, we don't have that kind of time, and that patient may need help or treatment like dialysis, which is another way of cleaning the blood.
Let's go there. Let's go there to what dialysis is and how you get it done.
Mm-hmm. So when we think about dialysis, I think we go back to thinking about what those jobs were that we expect the kidneys to be doing for us. The accounting of getting rid of salt and water, and also the processing or filtering of the blood and getting rid of things we don't need anymore. And dialysis can do those two functions. Can pull fluid as the patient's getting treatment and remove fluid from the body, and can also work very effectively as a filter to filter the blood.
So let me understand this. Let's say we were looking at a sort of a chart. Into the kidney comes the unfiltered material, and the kidney has to do that. Sometimes the kidney can't do it, so you're telling us that it is the dialysis machine that will do that for you.
Yes, and there are two ways that we can do that, and those two ways are actually very different. One is called hemodialysis. Hemo means blood. And so in hemodialysis, we find a way to access the blood in the person's body.
How do we do it?
We generally like to place a fistula, which is something that we do surgically in the arm that helps make one of the veins. Many people know you've tried to get blood work done before and they say, I can't find your veins because they're very small. So in the operating room, we actually create a vein that's much larger and stronger and can be accessed with needles so that blood can come out of the body. It then goes through a filter that filters that blood, cleans it, if you will, and then can also remove fluid while it's in there, and then the blood returns to the body, so you get your own blood back after it's been cleaned.
Okay, you said there were two ways.
Yes. Now, before I go to the second, hemodialysis is far and away the most common type of dialysis that we do in the U.S. Hemodialysis is generally done in the center, which means that as an outpatient, you would go to a center, and it's done three times a week for about 4 hours each time when you go.
Now, so it takes a lot of time.
It takes a lot of time. I guess there's pros and cons to everything. One of the pros is that all you have to do is kind of show up, you know, and the nurses will take care of you. The nurses will do everything that you need them to do while you're there. But we live in Albany and we have weather. And so if your treatment time is 6 a.m. and there's a snowstorm outside, your treatment time is still 6 a.m. unless we kind of figure something else out, which creates a lot of stress sometimes for the patient because they say, oh, boy, I don't want to miss my treatment. Sometimes stress for the family because they say, oh, we've got to get mom transported to the dialysis unit. And so it's certainly not a perfect treatment.
So, Vincent, what happens if you don't show up at that 6 a.m. time? Are you in trouble?
You definitely could be. Even one missed treatment can sometimes land a patient in the emergency room, sometimes with too much fluid in their system, or sometimes problems from those waste products building up in the system that makes you feel sick. But there is another way. The other way that is generally done is peritoneal dialysis. Peritoneum is actually your belly. In this type of dialysis, we do it at home. And so the patient is trained at a dialysis unit. It takes about a week and a half. Most everyone is capable of learning how to do it. And that patient, once they're trained, goes home and can actually do all their treatments at the convenience of their home. And so
now you have to learn how to clean the machine, for example, and do all of that stuff.
It's possible to do peritoneal dialysis without a machine. You don't even need to have electricity to
really?
Be able to do, we call it PD, short for peritoneal dialysis. So in many countries where they don't have as much resource as we have in the U.S., peritoneal dialysis is a much more common form of therapy because it's much more cost effective. In the U.S., only 8% of our patients do this type of therapy at home. And when you list the benefits to myself or to other people and you say, well, in this type of therapy, you can do everything at home. You get the privacy of not being exposed to a lot of other people who have chronic illness. You get the flexibility to do dialysis on your schedule, not on someone else's schedule. And if the roads are icy, so what? You're home, you're in your chair, you're watching your TV, and you're doing your treatment.
No, I'm confused. You said you don't have to have a machine. What do you mean?
Peritoneal dialysis is actually a bloodless form of dialysis. You never see a drop of blood. We place a catheter in the belly, and when that catheter is in, we can hang a bag of fluid, which most people have seen either on TV or they've been in a hospital and you see an IV fluid bag. It's just a soft plastic bag with clear fluid in there. We hang a large bag of that fluid. It drains into the belly and fills the belly up. And then a few hours later, you drain it out. Now, in the belly, there are thousands and thousands of tiny little blood vessels all over. You can't see them. They're inside. But those blood vessels have a lot of the stuff in them in a patient who has kidney failure that we want to get rid of. In that fluid that we put into the belly, there's none of it. And so because of that change in concentration, all those things move across the blood vessels into that fluid, and when you drain it out, you get rid of it. So you can clean your blood without ever seeing a drop of blood.
And this is as good as sitting with the nurses and having them take care of everything with the great machine?
It's every bit as good. So patients can get great dialysis and take advantage of all of those benefits that I mentioned. There's really very similar outcomes in terms of patients. If you look long-term at 5 years, for example, in terms of you might say, well, am I going to live longer with one or the other? They're very similar in that way. But when I talk to my own patients, and you talk to patients around the country, quality of life is better in a patient that can be home, that can set up their own travel.
And does it take as long as the dialysis with the nurses, the same 4 hours?
The schedule is different. And so one thing that's true about the peritoneal dialysis is it's not as efficient as the hemodialysis. So where hemo, you do it 4 hours, 3 times a week. Peritoneal, you do it. Most people actually, we do have a machine, even though I said you don't have to have one. There is a machine that can help you do the peritoneal dialysis where the fluid attaches to the machine, attaches to your belly. You push the button to go, and then you fall asleep. And that machine puts the fluid in and takes it out, puts it in, takes it out, all during the night while you're sleeping.
Wow.
When you wake up in the morning, you disconnect and you have your day to yourself. And that's 7 days a week. So you do it more often. You do it every day because it's not as efficient, but you have all your days to yourself. And one caveat to that, when we start to talk about the efficiencies of time there, because it's more efficient, hemodialysis is a punch. And so many people will complain to me who have gotten treatments, boy, when I leave dialysis, I just feel wiped out.
Now, this is a hemodialysis, if you're just joining us, is when you do it at a center, as opposed to a hospital or an office, as opposed to doing it yourself at home, which is known as
peritoneal dialysis.
Peritoneal dialysis. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, cost.
This is really, really important in an age where health policy is changing, and we're looking at the U.S. in particular as such an expensive system to provide care. And at the same time, people are making the argument that maybe we don't even provide as good quality as we could when you compare us to other countries. How do you make that better? And so I don't know that I have the answer to that for every facet of healthcare, but I have spent a lot of time thinking about it from a nephrology perspective. And with peritoneal dialysis, when you compare the two modalities and you say, boy, 90% of our patients are doing it in-center, only 8% are doing the peritoneal. It's about $15,000 per patient per year less expensive to do it at home.
So now your practice, which is a very good one, the top practice in our region, has set up these other centers where people go for dialysis. Is that not working to your satisfaction?
We have made home therapies a priority in our practice. And I would say that across the country, people are talking about it. I mean, it's not a mystery in terms of the cost differences. But as excited as I am and as passionate as I am about peritoneal dialysis, PD is not new. PD's been around for decades. It's just never become any more popular than 8%.
Why?
This is a challenging question, but I think I have at least some answers to throw out there. One is that I think we don't spend enough time training our nephrology fellows to learn home therapies, to be comfortable with it, so that when they go into practice, that it's a priority for them in their workplace. But there are others, too. Some people who don't get the benefit of robust education might be afraid to say, boy, I'm not a physician. I'm not a nurse. I don't know that I could do medical treatments for myself at home, not realizing that this is very simple. And I've had patients with, very experienced educational backgrounds, as well as people who, have less than high school education. I've had people who could barely move their fingers able to do this treatment. I've had a patient back when I was training who was blind and was able to do his own treatments at home. So the modality itself provides us with benefits to the patient, but also potentially benefits to the system. And one of the things that we've talked about, and with a partner of mine who does surgical procedures, a Dr. Galicio, we have created a new program that doesn't change the way peritoneal dialysis is done, but changes the way we approach choice and changes the way we approach education and involves a surgical technique that we have put together so that patients who want to do dialysis can have that option, who may not have had that in other places around the country, for various reasons. Some physicians look at patients differently, and they might say, that patient may not be a good candidate for home therapy because they're obese, for example, or because their diabetes is difficult to control, or because they have mobility issues.
Vincent, are those bags that you're holding up, as we see on television, prepared individually for each patient? In other words, if somebody is diabetic or not diabetic, does that make a difference?
We do have a lot of control over what we can do with the fluids. And with that, once the prescription is set and I say, all right, these are the kind of fluids that I think you need, a delivery is set up and those supplies are brought right to the patient's home.
Will Medicare pay for this?
Medicare definitely pays for this, and Medicaid as well. It was one of the provisions in the bill that Nixon passed in the 1970s that said all patients who have end-stage kidney disease would be able to benefit from Medicare regardless of their age. At the time, I think there were only about 200 dialysis patients. Now there are about 700,000. So I don't know that they realized what they were getting themselves into. But when you think about that, and it's interesting, from a Medicare standpoint, we're spending about $37 billion a year on end-stage renal disease care. And most of that care is expensive and being done in a center. And it's interesting that when you ask kidney doctors and you say, well, if you had to do dialysis yourself, which modality would you choose? It's not even close. 95% say they would do it at home. And so why are we not able to afford that same choice to our patients?
Why, indeed. When we return, we'll address that question. But I want to point out we're in conversation today with a friend of mine, a man who I very much admire, Dr. Vincent Carcillo, president and managing partner of Capital District Renal Physicians. Okay, so we want to return to that question which you just raised. Why, indeed? And this is the United States. Often we talk about money. Money must talk here somewhere, doesn't it? In other words, somebody's making money out of all of this going the old way as opposed to the new and more beneficial way.
I think that that was very true over the last several decades because dialysis was very well reimbursed. And when you look at that as a business, you know, the government was paying a lot of money for dialysis and everything was kind of broken down separately and they were paying for the treatment and paying for specific medications that would get delivered, and it was very, very expensive. Oh, 15 years ago, the process started that many specialties are just starting to see for the first time today where the CMS is bundling services together. So they're saying, well, tell us everything you need to do for the month, and we will write you one check. And so in this way, they're able to conserve on cost.
You just mentioned CMS. What's CMS?
Center for Medicare.
Okay.
So nephrology had faced this over a decade ago. And so we were probably one of the first specialties to be able to adjust to what is this concept of greater overall quality at lesser overall cost. And so dialysis has been managed that way for quite some time now. The issue of peritoneal dialysis versus hemodialysis, there are fewer costs associated with it. We just haven't been able to figure out how to get more patients to either appreciate that type of therapy, how to get nephrologists to appreciate that type of therapy, and how to really roll that out across the country. Different practices in different parts of the U.S. have different success rates and different physicians who may have had different experiences, may have had different approaches in terms of their conversations in the office or educational programs that they've created. But you'll see in some places in the country, practices have almost no home therapies patients. And I would say that in our area, because this is a focus, and I'm very proud of this, that although about 8% of patients have that choice and take advantage of that therapy around the country, in our practice, that number is about 25%.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned before that dialysis is sometimes a stopgap if you can't do surgery, if you can't get to surgery, if I heard you correctly. How often do people get to surgery?
This is a big challenge, and it's a great question, because about two-thirds of our patients that start dialysis because they showed up at the hospital and they're sick. And so traditionally, what's done for that patient is a hemodialysis catheter, or a tube that gets inserted into one of the large blood vessels, is placed. When that's placed, that patient then goes to what is essentially a pretty small room in the hospital and receives that dialysis treatment for the first time, where blood's coming out of the body, going through a filter, and coming back to them. And this can be a very scary thing. And you're surrounded in a small room by maybe three or four other patients, and the experience is not ideal. Many of these patients are also very sick. Some may be elderly with pneumonia and coughing. Others might be, you know, in the hospital because of advanced diabetes and might have a fresh amputation. And you look around the room and you say, oh my goodness, is this my life? And what if you're 26 years old? This is a very scary experience. We took that and we thought hard and long about what that experience is like and what we would want the experience to be like. What we would want that experience to be like if it was our father, if it was ourselves. And so for those two-thirds of the dialysis population, they never really get the opportunity to think about home therapies, because home therapies is generally done, that catheter is placed in the OR, and the catheter takes about 2 weeks to heal up before you can use it.
I'm sorry for interrupting, Vincent, but does the hospital lose income if you do home therapy as opposed to the hospital doing it?
This is another great question. Yeah, and you're amazing. So the hospital doesn't lose money depending on which modality the patient chooses. But I will tell you that hemodialysis in many cases is very cumbersome. The catheter that gets placed, this is, imagine, half outside the body, half inside of a blood vessel. And so the rate of infection is super high. So that catheter might get placed one day as the patient is in a room with another ill patient, and before you know it, they have a fever, and now it's another several days of figuring out if there is infection. And then once the patient comes through all that, now we have to find an outpatient dialysis unit in the area that has a chair and is ready to take that patient. And so sometimes that patient may stay in the hospital for 2 weeks. The hospital does lose money when the patient stays in the hospital for so long. Home therapies, at least in our experience locally, can have unlimited capacity as long as the outpatient units have home nurses that can train patients. There's no chair time, and there's no facility that the patient has to be at physically for their treatment. So you can have that patient who may be otherwise well, not acutely ill and needing to have hospital services, and get that patient home very quickly.
You mentioned that you and your surgeon partner, one of the people in your fairly extensive practice, worked out a new surgical methodology. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So we wanted to address this problem of what's one of the biggest challenges that we have. Well, if two-thirds of our patients never get the choice for home therapies, well, you're really never going to be able to change that 8% number. And so the issue was, if we place this catheter and we have to wait 2 weeks, well, that's not a solution. None of those patients can wait 2 weeks that show up sick. And so we put together a program, and that program has several facets to it. One of them starts with the nephrologist and their interaction with the patient. And we can do this from the office setting too. You have a patient that's getting very close to needing dialysis and you need to do something. And so I like to give that patient choice. And I like to talk through the things that we're talking about now. What are the avenues that you have available to you? What do you think would be better for you? What would you like to do with your body? It can't be overstated how important that first conversation is. Because patients who are starting dialysis sometimes feel so overwhelmed. Maybe they don't know much about it. Maybe they think, oh, this is something that's the beginning of the end, that I'm going to pass away with this. And it's so overwhelming that they feel like they don't have any control. There's no control over their life. There's no control over their body. And so the first step is to empower that patient to be able to make a choice and take some of that control back. And when we do that, I find that many of my patients would be interested in those benefits that we talked about. And that's patients in the office, but it's also the patient that comes to the hospital, maybe didn't know that they had kidney failure, and it's so bad that they need to start dialysis very soon. Well, we can still give that patient a choice. Once we have that conversation, if the patient tells me that, yes, I would like to move forward with this. I don't leave it at that. I bring an educator in, and that educator spends about 2 hours with the patient. And if it's in the hospital, so be it. We bring our educator to the hospital bed, and we spend some time showing the patient a mannequin, a video, really going through what day-to-day life might be like, so that they feel like that warm blanket of comfort, that they feel really confident in the decision that they're making. Then we work things out with colleagues. You know, one of the things that many people need before they go to an operating room is clearance from their cardiologist. And a lot of people have been through that. You know, you had to get some kind of even a dental procedure. They want you to go and get to the cardiologist and make sure that they feel okay with it. Well, in many places, this creates delay. But locally, our friends in cardiology have been very receptive to this, and they want the best for these patients. And they're willing to get to that patient quickly and make sure that they do a risk assessment. And once that's done, our surgeon, Dr. Galicio, takes over. And he places a catheter that, believe it or not, we can use that catheter the same day if we need to, which is a game changer. Because now if you don't have to wait 2 weeks and you have a patient that can start the same day, maybe they could be discharged the same day. Maybe they don't have to spend 2 weeks in the hospital around people who may have infectious diseases. Maybe they don't have to have an experience of going to that small dialysis room surrounded by people who may be very, very ill compared to them.
But are they prepared to go home, Dr. Carcillo, and to start doing this right away on the same day? I mean, it's got to be very scary.
It can be, and that's why the continuity is so important. And so you can see we've kind of put these pieces in along the way where everyone is holding hands. And once that patient is surgically then ready to go home, we have our outpatient nurses ready to go, and they're ready to train that patient the next day. And the nephrologist is there to participate in that training process and help out with it. And so you can imagine, and I can give you some examples because I'm very excited about what we've done for patients here in the Capital District. But you can imagine the difference between those two experiences. That first patient who was terrified, who had a catheter placed maybe in the neck, sometimes in the groin. That patient rolling into a dialysis unit, getting a treatment for 3 or 4 hours, surrounded by people who may be very ill, spending 2 weeks in the hospital, feeling like they don't have control. Compare that to the patient in this what we call seamless PD program, where there's hand-holding all along the way. The nephrologist hands off to the educator, who hands off to the cardiologist, who hands off to the surgeon. That handoff is then complete when the patient leaves the hospital in a very timely way and goes to an outpatient unit and doesn't get their treatment in a room full of other people, but has a cup of coffee in a room with a one-to-one nurse and starts learning how to do their treatment themselves.
So it seems to me that we Americans love to do what our doctors tell us. Doctor says, okay, here's a choice. And we say, we don't know about choices. Just tell me what to do. Dr. Carcillo, you went to school, you know about this. Tell us what to do. So we know that one of the reasons we only have 8% doing what you consider to be the right thing is not enough doctors are saying, do what I tell you, do it this way.
And that may be, and it's something that doctors definitely struggle with, is that sometimes the doctor will feel like, I know what the right thing is. Let me just tell you what to do. But there does need to be an approach to that. And we do want the patients to feel like they have choice. And we do want them to, frankly, have choices. I think there is a way to have patients participate in decision making, participate in their care, and actually feel like they have control over a situation and have a physician with them who can really guide them towards what they believe is the right decision. And many times I'll tell patients, I'm going to give you some choices, but I'm going to be honest with you too. I'm going to tell you what I think is the right thing for you.
Because they always ask, what would you do, doctor?
Many times they do. They'll say, well, what if this was you? Well, what would you do? And I'll tell them, and I'm very honest with patients. And I'm honest about something else too. And I think that this is sometimes controversial because in the medical field, we want everybody to be better. That's not always possible. And so what I tell patients, because dialysis can be a struggle. In-center dialysis, imagine 3 times a week, 4 hours for the foreseeable future or maybe the rest of your life if you're not a candidate for transplantation. This is a lot to take on. Are there benefits to it? Do you get time back because you get to survive? Yes. but not everybody sees it the same way. And what I tell patients across the board when I'm talking with them about dialysis is, if you're just going to do dialysis to survive, I don't recommend it, because I think you might be miserable. If you're going to do dialysis because you want to live your life, then do dialysis, because any treatment should have upside to it that gives the patient the life that they hope to, or at least aspire to be able to maintain.
How about length of life? Are people living longer with dialysis than they used to?
Yes, actually. What we see in dialysis is that we take care of some of the sickest patients out there. And when you look at mortality rates, patients who do dialysis have mortality rates that are in some instances similar to lung cancer. And so we don't often...
That's very bad, right?
It's very bad. It's very bad. And in the recent past, upwards of 24% of our patients did not make it through the first year. And only 35 to 40% are still receiving treatment at 5 years. So this is not great. But what we're finding is we are starting to see some improvement. I would say that the rate of people who are incident patients or brand new dialysis patients is not going up as dramatically as we thought maybe that it would as the population is getting older. But we are seeing that the prevalent number of patients or the total number of dialysis patients at any given time is growing. And so that tells you that the patients who we have on therapy are actually living longer.
Tell me about symptoms. I think a lot of the people who are listening to this will want to know, when do I think I have kidney problems and what should I be looking for?
It's talked about sometimes with hypertension, but it's also true of kidney disease.
Hypertension meaning that you have high blood pressure.
Of high blood pressure, yes, absolutely. People talk about hypertension and high blood pressure, you know, is that kind of buzz phrase that it was the silent killer. Kidney disease can be that way too. And in many cases, kidney disease is related to high blood pressure.
Which comes first, the high blood pressure or the kidney?
Oh, this is a good chicken and the egg kind of question. And kidney disease can cause high blood pressure. High blood pressure can cause kidney disease. So depending on the patient, both answers could be correct. But it's not number one. In the U.S., diabetes is the number one etiology or cause for kidney failure, with high blood pressure being number two. And then there are primary diseases that we don't know where they come from, but they affect people commonly. Those are the main causes. Now, with diabetes, well, there are symptoms related to diabetes. Sometimes excessive thirst or excessive urination can tip someone off to the fact that something's not right. And then they find out, oh, I have a high blood sugar that they found at the primary care doctor's office. People who are obese or even just overweight are sometimes at risk for diabetes.
And for kidney too?
Obesity? And for kidney failure too. I have patients that I follow in the office who don't have diabetes, who don't have high blood pressure, but are obese, and we see signs of kidney damage that are related to that obesity.
You know, this may be a little bit off, but Dr. Carcillo, I know that there's been evidence that after obese people have that reduction operation, that the diabetes goes away. Is it also true that kidneys improve?
In some cases, it actually is. And that is true with, you know, surgically related weight loss, but also patients who are able to get that weight off on their own will see that in many cases, the number of blood pressure medicines goes down or maybe goes away. And same thing for their diabetic medication. Sometimes they need less. Sometimes they don't require them altogether. So weight loss is so important if your physician tells you that you might have something called the metabolic syndrome, which is generally an obese person who starts to show signs of resistance to insulin, which is kind of an early way of finding diabetes.
Okay, so let's go to other things that may have to do with the kidneys. Let's talk about kidney cancer for a moment. We're finding that people get it. And how does that relate to everything else we've been talking about today?
Well, kidney cancer is something that affects the whole population. We have younger patients that are coming in, sometimes in their 20s.
Do we know what brings it on?
Well, like other cancers, there are these kind of common risk factors. People who have been exposed to tobacco smoke, people who have maybe had some chemical or toxic exposures and that kind of thing. But some people, they present with just some blood in the urine, and then we find out, lo and behold, there is a mass. Now, our urology colleagues have come a long way in their ability to treat this. Sometimes they're just monitoring Sometimes in the past, they had to remove the entire kidney if that was an issue. And modern treatment involves sometimes just removing that portion of the kidney that holds the mass, which allows us as nephrologists to continue to treat that patient in a chronic kidney disease setting, as opposed to you're removing the whole kidney, and in many cases, that patient would need dialysis.
So we've been talking to Dr. Vincent Carcillo, president and managing partner of Capital District Renal Physicians. Okay, so Dr. Carcillo, let's go to this business of blood in your urine. Every time somebody talks about kidney cancer, one of the first things that comes up when you see blood, how often is that true?
We see blood in the urine just about every day at the office. And many times it's a patient who isn't sick. And we'll find a patient that will come and say, I was trying to get life insurance and they came to my house and I gave a urine sample. I don't have any problems. I don't take any medicines. They saw some blood in my urine and they say, I have to see you first before I can get my life insurance. So we see a lot of patients who are well. We see patients that blood in the urine can span a very broad spectrum of disease. In some instances, we don't even find a cause for it. And there are reasons that sometimes we don't. If the patient is very, very well, and we rule out those more sinister things, we rule out the fact that, you know, we say, okay, you know, we've looked into it, you don't have cancer in your kidneys. We've looked into it, and we don't see signs of serious kidney damage going on.
So what's the diagnostic procedure for figuring out whether somebody has cancer? Do you take pictures? I mean, how does it work?
Yeah, well, sometimes we'll look at the urine and we'll sometimes send that urine for evaluation to a laboratory looking for cancer cells. We will check the blood and check the immune system. Blood in the urine can sometimes trigger an investigation for immune system related kidney disease. In those cases, many times there's also protein in the urine, which is another marker of damage.
And we call this proteinuria?
Yeah, we call this proteinuria. And if those two are present together, it makes us even more concerned that maybe this is a primary kidney disease. The blood test can be very helpful sometimes, and sometimes they lead us to say, we need even more information. And in those cases, we do a kidney biopsy, or actually get a small piece of kidney tissue that then gets further analyzed, and many times this is the gold standard then for a diagnosis.
Do cancers metastasize from other places to the kidney?
Very few actually metastasize from other places to the kidney. Kidney cancers, on the reverse of that, can also metastasize to other places. Many times, especially in our kind of more elderly patients, if it's a small lesion that does not seem to be changing, the urologist will kind of weigh out the risks and benefits of doing surgery on that person if the lesion doesn't seem to be one that's growing or likely to metastasize to other places.
Well, we do read on a fairly regular basis about people who had kidney cancer and had a chunk of their kidney removed. Is this growing more prevalent?
Yeah, especially with the introduction of robotic surgeries, and our surgical colleagues are very precise with what they can do now. Sometimes they can freeze certain lesions, and the creativity is out there so that they're able to have a lot more choices in what they do to be able to effectively remove that lesion and leave as much functional tissue then as possible.
You mentioned some of the symptoms, one of which I think will scare anybody as you grow older, which is increased needing to use the lavatory. Does this fall to the urologist usually, or do you do it?
It sometimes does, but we see that very commonly. And I'll tell you, several...
The older you get, the more you have to pee.
Yeah, in general, that's true, but in guys especially. So gentlemen have a gland called the prostate gland. And so between the bladder and the outside world is this tube that many people have heard of that's called the urethra. And in ladies, it's shorter for obvious reasons. In men, it's a little bit longer and extends through the penis. And so the prostate gland in men wraps itself around that tube. As long as the prostate's nice and small, it doesn't cause any issues at all. But gentlemen, as we get older, that prostate gland gets a little bigger and maybe a little bit bigger. And just like your garden hose, if it gets big enough to crimp the tube, well, now you're going to have a hard time getting that urine out. And you might back up pressure into your bladder. It might feel like, I never really get my bladder empty. I feel like I always have to go. And in the worst case scenario, and I see this in the hospital at least once a week, is a patient that shows up that is just sick. And when we check the blood work, oh, the kidney function is terrible. And in that case, and this is maybe a gentleman older than 60 years old usually, the tube's gotten completely crimped, they're not passing any urine, and there's such back pressure that it's actually caused the kidneys to fail.
Let's talk a little bit about kidney versus bladder. These are two different organs, but they have to do with each other, don't they?
Sure do. And in that setting especially, you know, the bladder can become very distended and sometimes damaged by all that distension.
Now, nephrologists work on bladders too, right?
Not so much. As they relate to being able to pass that urine effectively, we don't like urine that's kind of hanging out in one place in a pool. We want fluids to be moving through that renal tract. As urine's being made in the kidneys, we want it moving quickly through the ureter, which is the tube that goes from the kidney to the bladder. Not spending much time in the bladder, although there are certain times, like at night, when you sleep, where you want the bladder to be able to be a reservoir for that urine. But if it stays too long, just like a stagnant pool of water, it's likely to get infected.
And now, so, I have a friend who's always complaining that no matter what he does, if he takes a nap or if he sleeps the night, he's got to pee after he's slept. Mm. Is there an explanation for that?
Well, this is the way we want the system to work, right? So you want to be able to go to sleep and maybe spend 8 or, if you're lucky, longer asleep. And you don't want your body functions to interrupt your sleep. So you don't want to have to wake up multiple times. And so the kidney is actually a pretty smart organ. If you think about different situations, maybe you think about a person who's walking through the desert, right? It's very hot. They're sweating. They're losing fluids. The body senses that I don't want to lose more fluids or I'm not going to make it. The kidneys are able to really concentrate that urine. And when you concentrate the urine, it's less volume. And so if there's less volume, it doesn't distend the bladder as much. And if it doesn't distend the bladder, you don't feel like you have to go. And this is the normal process that happens every day when a person goes to sleep. They sleep through the night, the kidneys concentrate that urine, you don't make a lot of volume, but then when you wake up in the morning, you got to go. The opposite's also true. If you're in a setting where you're drinking lots of water, well, we talked about the accounting of fluids coming in have to come out. So if you're drinking lots and lots of water, well, the kidneys are going to say, we need to dilute the urine, make a lot of volume so we can get rid of all this water that just came in. And so it's interesting to see that there is that balance that's going on every day, even though we don't think about it.
So what about color? I mean, a lot of people are looking at their pee and they say, whoa, why is it lighter or darker?
Yes, I get that all the time in the office. Lots of different reasons and ways that the body can change the character of the urine. I'll give you just kind of a few common examples that are not related to disease, but just related to things that happen. People who like to eat asparagus, for example.
Yeah.
There is a component in the asparagus, not one that you see, but just a chemical component that's in there. And then when you excrete that, it has an odor to it. And there's that classic smell and you say, oh, you know what? I get it. I had asparagus. I didn't even realize it last night, but now my urine has that asparagus smell.
And there are an awful lot of people who get the gout who complain that they can't eat shrimp or asparagus.
That's right, for different chemical reasons that are in those foods. But the same is also true. For example, we talked about blood in the urine. So if you eat a lot of beets, beets have a lot of red pigment in them.
That's why I don't eat beets. Because I wake up the next morning and I'm always sure that I have cancer.
And you panic, right? Yeah. Oh, it's very true. It's very true. And it sometimes it is very scary if you haven't seen that before. But there are medications that can turn the urine, you know, all different colors of the rainbow. And sometimes supplements. People will go to a health food store, for example, and get a multivitamin. Maybe one of the components that's holding that multivitamin together, oh, it's not the vitamin D, but it's something else that's kind of binding it up. Once you metabolize that, your urine is that super, super bright, you know, neon yellow. So different things can change the character of the urine that don't necessarily mean you have a disease.
So let's go back to where we started on this business of dialysis. Mm. In so many ways, you know, you see all of these motion pictures about people who had a thesis about the way things should be done, and they're laughed at in the beginning. You're experiencing some of that, aren't you? People who are resisting the idea that you have this idea about how we could really be treating our dialysis patients better.
That may be, but I'm so positive and so passionate about this, I think we can make a difference in 50 states across the U.S. If we take this as an example of, here's a practice that wants to give patients a choice, and then you give them a new tool, a way to get patients onto therapy the next day that we never had before.
Well, I would do it in a minute if that were the case with me. And you would do it. But people are scared. They say, well, what would happen if something happens in the middle of the night when I'm sleeping? You know, I won't have professionals around to help me out. Isn't that one of the things that stops us from moving ahead here?
It can be. And that's why education is so important. You know, I talked about that
sure.
Safety blanket. When I've talked about this before, and I showed people a picture of when I taught my youngest daughter to ski. She didn't ski next to me. She skied with her skis between my skis and my poles in front of her, and she held on, and she felt safe. That's what we need to provide to patients. They need to feel that they have the answers to those questions, that there isn't this darkness that I'm moving into, that they have the answer that, don't worry, when you leave the hospital, you're going to get a call from, you know, Nurse Chris or Nurse Jenna. And they are going to walk you through how they're going to help you and how they're going to train you and where you have to be and when. And if you have a problem, here's the number you call, and there's going to be someone there to support you and feel that you have what you need to say, you know what, I can do this, because so many people can do it.
So do you have allies around the country who are where you are in terms of making this happen?
I do. And I'm very much looking forward to doing a few different things. I think that the possibility is there to really start a training program where we can bring surgeons in from around the country and show them what we're doing. And we're in discussion right now with St. Peter's Health Partners to be able to do that and to be able to show that Albany can be a beacon and that we can make a change right here that might affect the entire country. And also working with partners in industry.
How about the major providers? I mean, you have all these insurance companies who are obviously going to see that there's a potential for saving some money here.
The thing that I really love about this, and there's so many things I love about this, but one of the things that I really love is that everyone is a winner here. It's not a situation where, unfortunately, you got to give somewhere. The patient gets a better quality of life. The patient gets to live their life on dialysis. The government stands to save, if you take that number, if you take 700,000 patients and you say only 8% do a therapy where $15,000 a year can be saved, and you just take that number to 18%, you might say, then that's not a big number. And it's not. And I think that we can do a lot better than that. But even if you just take it there, you're saving a few billion dollars a year for Medicare. And if you take that patient who would have stayed in the hospital for 2 weeks, and you shorten that hospitalization, the hospital is saving money now. And if you take that patient who had CDPHP insurance or some other commercial insurance, that insurance company also has to spend less money to take care of the patient. So the patient is at the heart of this. The patient does better, and everyone else is a winner, including society in general, because of this challenge that we're facing across the country with the overwhelming cost of medical care.
Now, are you in a position to, or are they, the Medicare and the various providers, insurance companies, are they in a position to make this happen?
I think we're really at the early stages. We put this program together, and over the last year, we wanted to show that, is it really true? Is it just all smoke and mirrors? Or are you really able to make this happen?
Okay, so Dr. Carcillo, we only have 3 or 4 minutes left. I want to have you, because people start listening to the radio in the middle. They don't always listen from the beginning. Give us a little primer on these choices that we are having. Right now, you could go to a facility and have dialysis done, and this is known as
hemodialysis. Hemo meaning blood, where blood is coming out of your body, going through a tube, and into a machine that filters that blood. Then the blood comes back to you.
And that machine has to be properly cleaned. I once knew a guy who was in charge of cleaning the machine. I have a bad story in my head and I don't want to tell it, but there is that. Then there's the other way, which is you're going to be delivered basically bags of solution. You hang them up and you use them while you sleep at night. And this is called?
This is called peritoneal dialysis, peritoneum being your belly. So your belly actually becomes the dialyzer. Your belly is the filter.
Do you have to sleep on your back?
You don't. You have patients that sleep on their back, on their side. Might be a little difficult to sleep on your belly, but most other positions are acceptable.
Well, you're lucky. Unlike my mother, who put me on my tummy, and that's the way I've slept all of my life. Mm. But yeah, you have to learn how to do something else.
Yeah, so some people might have to spend some time adjusting to it. And again, what we talked about before was with hemodialysis, you're going into a center, so you're traveling somewhere for about 4 hours, three times a week. And this is an efficient treatment. So again, a lot of people feel washed out afterwards. So the common cycle that I hear frequently is, I live for dialysis. I go to dialysis, I feel washed out, I go home, I fall asleep. The next day, I've got some time to myself. And then the following day, we're back at it and we're doing dialysis and we're starting to feel washed out again. Home dialysis, especially the kind we're talking about, peritoneal dialysis, is done every day. And most patients choose to do it at night while they sleep. So you might say, oh, that's a lot of treatment. But because it's less efficient, it's more gentle.
What if they travel? What if you have to travel somewhere? You can't take it with you, can you?
I'll give you a great example. And I've had so many wonderful experiences with patients over the years. I had a patient, and this gentleman just loved to go on cruises. And at the time, I had never been on a cruise, so I didn't have a lot of experience to be able to help him out. And so he would make a phone call. All of his peritoneal dialysis supplies were delivered to the boat. He showed up. Nobody even knew. He didn't have to go on a special medical cruise where there was stigma attached to it. He went on a cruise with everybody else, and he would go on these long 30-day cruises to Alaska or other places. All his supplies were on the boat. Nobody even knew he was doing his treatment. And guess what? He lived his life.
We've been in conversation today with Dr. Vincent Carcillo, president and managing partner of Capital District Renal Physicians. Dr. Carcillo, a man I very much admire. Thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate all the time you've given us and how busy you are.
Alan, thank you so much for having me, for giving me the opportunity to speak about something that I'm so passionate about. I very much appreciate being here with you.